Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. This episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Dan Klein, who is the translator and I guess editor in some ways, but of the new, he so far has put out Bereishis and Shemais, and Vayikra will be coming out shortly, of Shadal's Pirush al HaTorah, which is Shmuel David Lutzato, who's going to be the focus of this podcast, his, life, Shadal's, and his works, and the new editions of the Chumash that he's publishing in English, the translation in English, and we'll discuss that. So with that, thank you, Dan, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't we start off, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, when I spoke at YU after my translation of Shemot came out, I pointed out that I'm a good example of a good YU education. And I don't have smicha. I attended what was then called EMC, or Michael College, which is now Isaac Breuer College. There, I got a very good grounding in the Hebrew language, in Jewish history, in Tanakh. We learned Gemara too. The only difference is that I inherited a certain affinity for languages from my grandfather and my father. Here's what happened. My father was in the aerospace industry in the 1960s. He did a lot of international travel. He went especially to France, Germany, and Holland. And he was very much a people person. He wanted to communicate directly with people. And so he went to a bunch of Berlitz total immersion language courses and learned how to speak French and German and Dutch. He was the kind of person who didn't really care about the grammar. He would just plunge into a conversation. He was a people person. I'm not quite that way, but he felt that languages were such an important asset to have that he encouraged me and my three siblings to learn a new language. And he didn't mean Hebrew because we'd been learning Hebrew. He meant something else. So what happened was he first went to one of my younger brothers with a little red Berlitz travel guide in Russian and said, here, learn Russian. And wouldn't you know, he did. He's a very smart boy. And to this day, he's living in Israel now. He's a patent agent and he puts his Russian to good use. So my father didn't come directly to me and with another book and say, here, learn this. I figured, well, if my little brother is doing this, I can do it too. I looked at the bookshelf in our living room and all I could see there was a little green Berlitz book of Italian for tourists. And I was thinking, well, this may not be my first choice, but let's take a look. And I very quickly realized that not only was this a fairly easy language to learn, it's a very beautiful language. So that's how I got my start. Next part of the story involves my grandmother, not my father's mother, my mother's mother, who was the daughter of Rav Hillel Klein. Some people may know that name. The rabbi of Old Tzedek in New York in the early part of the 20th century. She, unusually for a woman who was the rabbi's daughter and grew up in the Lower East Side and then in Harlem, she went to college. She went to Barnard and she studied there. She majored in French and she also took courses in Italian. And when she heard I was teaching myself Italian, she said, oh, I think I can help you. And she gave me some of her textbooks that she had learned from and that helped me along. Then she changed my life entirely. She said, here, look at this book. I think you'll be interested. It was this book. It was the Bereishis volume of Shadal that had come from her father's library. And I'll just show you what the interior looks like. You have, can you see the original Hebrew text on one side, the Italian translation on top, and a Hebrew parish on the bottom. Shadal wrote the Italian translation of the text and the Hebrew parish. This was a very unusual thing for any one scholar to do. So at this point, I was, I don't know, maybe 13, 14, not much older than that. And the first thing I did with this Chumash was I looked at some of the familiar psukim to see what they sounded like in Italian, just as sort of an amusement. Then my eye went down to the Perush in Hebrew on the bottom of the page, and I began to read it, and I said to myself, this makes sense. This is good. Several years later, after I had had more experience reading it, it occurred to me that I have an unusual skill set. I've taught myself Italian. I can understand Hebrew. Not a whole lot of people in the world are familiar with this work. I can present it to the world in English. And so this was when I was in law school. I was, it was a summer between my first and second year, I think, I started to translate Voracious. And I didn't know how long it would take. I didn't know if it would ever be published. It was a labor of love. I decided early on that it was just as important to translate the Italian text translation as it was the Parish. We can get into that a little bit more. So that's what I did. About 20 years later, I was finished and I was looking around for publisher. And at the time, Jason Aronson was a very important publisher of Judaica. They took it on. And in 1998, that first volume was printed. It took me another 15 years or so to finish Shamos. Then that was printed. By this time, Jason Aronson had sort of transitioned out of active Jewish publishing. I needed somebody else. So I found Kodesh Press, Rabbi Alec Goldstein, and he very enthusiastically took on the project. And so I was on. And from there on, we both agreed that I should go on, finish the Chumash, and see what else I can do. So the first thing we did after Shamos was to reissue Bereishis, because by then it was hard to find on the market. There were corrections that I wanted to make from 20 years before, about 2 years ago. Vayikra is not nearly as long a volume as Bereishis or Shamos, and so it took a little bit shorter time. Now that I was motivated to finish, I speeded up a bit, and Vayikra is almost ready for publication. So that's the story of how I got involved. What's your next question?
Okay, so I think my next question will be, now that you covered yourself, and I guess what got you into Shadal. So I think it's probably best if we give a brief, or it might be a little bit more than brief, overview or biography of Shadal, who obviously, like I said, was Shmuel Dovid Lutzato, and who was he? Who was this person who wrote the Chumash that you translated?
Okay, that's an interesting story. The Lutzato family has many well-known members. The Frum community, probably the best known, is Moshe Chaim Lutzato Ramchal. This was, I believe, the great-granduncle of Shadal. He lived in the 1700s. Shadal was in the 1800s. To my knowledge, Shadal doesn't ever mention Ramchal in his writings. I've never come across it yet, but there was definitely a connection. There were various other leading figures. They were poets, they were physicians, they were all kinds of interesting people. Part of the Lutzato family, by the way, they were Ashkenazim in origin. They came from Germany. And part of the family took on the plural form of Lutzato. Their name was Lutzati. Luigi Lutzati, I think his name was the first Jewish prime minister of Italy back in 1910. Another interesting factoid about the Lutzato family is there was a Fiorina Lutzato who lived in Italy in the mid to late 1800s. Her name Fiorina means little flower. Her grandson was named after her, but they changed the name to a masculine form from Fiorina to Fiorello. His last name was LaGuardia. Fiorello LaGuardia was the mayor of New York, after whom the airport was named. We can't blame him for that. And he was halachically Jewish. So that's another part of the Lutzato family. Just this year, I believe a great or great-great grandson of Shadal passed away. He was Amos Lutzato, who was a very leading figure in the Italian Jewish community and himself wrote some Perushim. He wrote a Perush on Shir HaShirim. There is an American branch of the Lutzato family. There is a Tony or Anthony Luzzatto Gardner, who I believe was the ambassador to the European Union from the United States. He's been talked about as possibly being the new ambassador to Britain. So there are Luzzattos to this day. Okay, back to Chadal. He was born in 1800, died in 1865. There was a time when I was teaching Jewish history to high school girls here in Rochester. And I said, if there's one thing I want you to remember from these classes, it's this. The Vilna Gaon lived at the same time as George Washington. So, might be surprised at some people. So in the same vein, Chadal lived at the same time as Abraham Lincoln. He died in the same year. Even though he was part of this illustrious Luzzatto family, it was the poorer branch. They didn't have much means of support. He didn't have much of an education, a formal education. At the age of 13, he had some sort of a sickness and the doctor decided he shouldn't be in school anymore. But he very, very eagerly read on his own. He continued studying with his father, with the chief rabbi of Trieste, which is the city where he was born. Another factoid, we think of Chadal as an Italian, and he was, in the sense that he lived in a geographic region called Italy. He spoke Italian, he was of Italian culture, but he never was a citizen of a country called Italy. It's kind of, you could say Moses Mendelssohn was a German. He never lived in a country called Germany. These countries became unified afterwards. It was the native city that Chadal was born in was Trieste, which was part of the Austrian Empire at the time. He spent most of his career in Padua or Padova, which is a very Italian city, but again, was part of the Austrian Empire. It was only the year after he died that Padova became part of the new Kingdom of Italy. And Trieste only became part of Italy after World War I. So it's another little oddity of who he was. It's actually significant in a way that he lived under the Austrian rule, because it was the Austrians who decided it would be a good idea to have a modern type rabbinical school. Not just a yeshiva for learning for Lishma, but were actually training rabbis to be rabbis. This was a fairly new idea. And in the late 1820s, Chadal was hired as one of the two professors in a brand new Collegio Rabbinico in Padua. What he taught was Tanakh, Hebrew language, Jewish history, and something called religion. The other professor at the Collegio was the one who taught Gemara. Not that he couldn't have, he was a Talmud Chacham in his own right, which is another little oddity about him. He was not a rabbi. He did not have smicha. Some people assume that he did, but if you look at his biography, he was offered smicha by one of his teachers. He refused, because back in those days, apparently an important part of being a rabbi was public speaking, which he didn't care to do. And he wanted to spend more time researching Tanakh and doing these things that would have taken away from his public duties as a rabbi. He didn't want it. At some point, he was given some sort of like an honorary smicha. One of the leading Italian rabbis of his day gave him an elaborate piece of parchment that said, "You are such a Talmud Chacham, we were going to call you Ma'alat HaChacham." But he never actually used that title. He was just Chadal. He insisted that he was not a posek or anything of the sort. So for the most of his adult life, he was a professor at this Collegio Rabbinico. He apparently was very much loved by his students, and he devoted his career to them. Most of the Italian rabbis of the later 19th century were his students. He was their mentor. Where are we about Chadal? Yeah, his personal life was very difficult. He was never a rich man by any means. The Collegio didn't pay him very well. They esteemed him greatly. He was recognized everywhere as a terrific scholar, but they never had much money to pay him. His personal life was in a way filled with tragedy, because his first wife for many years suffered from a terrible depression. She eventually died, and it's never made quite clear, but it seems possibly that she committed suicide. He ended up marrying, after she died, he ended up marrying her sister, which was a happy second marriage. Unfortunately, several of his children died before he did, some in infancy, some as adults. Possibly the worst tragedy of his life was the death of his firstborn son, who he named Ohev Ger, after his book about Onkelos. In Italian, that comes out to Filoseno. Filoseno was developing into quite a scholar in his own right, but unfortunately died in his 20s of cancer. And this was a blow from which Shadal really never quite recovered. So he had his troubles. He also made a certain amount of enemies, but he was very well thought of mostly in the European Jewish world. He even had non-Jewish friends. I'm just doing some research now about a Monsignor Nardi, who was a very Frum Catholic, who taught at the University of Padua, and they were friends for many, many years. They had these very friendly exchange of letters about things, and, you know, words and phrases in the Tanakh. It was a very interesting thing. So that's pretty much Shadal's personal life. And where would he go from there now?
So I wanted to mention also, first of all, you said he came from Trieste. It's not exactly in the boot of Italy, almost, so to speak. It's like, unlike
the northeastern corner.
Yeah, it's really, it doesn't even look like it's part of Italy, almost, so to speak. It is. Another famous
Lutzato. Venice, actually.
Yeah, another famous Lutzato that you didn't mention was Reb Simcha Lutzato. Simon Lutzato was the Rav in Venice, right?
Yeah, that was part of the family, yes.
Yeah, just wanted to mention him as well. So you alluded to Ohev Ger, and we've already mentioned the Chumash, but I think maybe just speak about his classical, you know, works. Well, what Svarim that he wrote, just to finish off his biography, I guess.
Okay, I've made a bit of a list. You could say that his most important works, the earliest one is Ohev Ger, which I mentioned before. It's a work about the principles and techniques which Onkelos used in writing his Targum. I'll discuss that a little bit later, I guess. He wrote a short book called Yesodei HaTorah about his philosophy of how Yiddishkeit works. It was translated in the 60s as Lutzato's Ethico-Psychological Interpretation of Judaism. It's a beautiful little work. And another of his important works was a collection of poetry of Yehuda Halevi, the Diwan L'Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. We tend to think of him as somebody who wrote Kinos for Tisha B'Av, but his body of work of poetry was much more extensive than that. For a long time, it was not well known or not published or not available. Lutzato did a lot of effort in digging out old manuscripts and old books and really brought it back into the public knowledge. Probably his most important works were his Perushim. Principally, he wrote translations in Italian and Perushim in Hebrew for the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, for Yeshaya, which is considered by some as his masterwork, and also Iov. To a lesser extent, he was involved with Yirmiyah, Yechezkel, and Mishlei. He didn't write translations of them. He wrote Hebrew Perushim, which are what we have now. Many of his writings are kind of scattered around and haven't been collected. There's no one bookshelf, you know, the complete works of Shadal. Where you have many of his important writings is in collections of his letters. His Hebrew letters to some of the leading Jewish scholars at the time are collected in two volumes called Igrot Shadal, which contain many fascinating things. And he also wrote letters in Italian and in French and in Latin. And those are collected in a different collection called the Epistolario, a collection of letters. Those are his most important works, I think. There are others as well, but those are the headlines.
Right. Okay. I think that's good. So I think the other ones that I would mention, and maybe we'll get to some of those in depth now, perhaps. And then the ones that I would mention is, first of all, he published, I think, in Eitzer Nechmad, right, in a journal, Keheles, his Pirush and Keheles, with his famous introduction, or maybe to some people it's infamous, but perhaps you want to talk a little bit about that one.
Okay. This is not something I'm really familiar with, but I've boned up a little bit about it. First of all, where it's, if you look at the collected writings of Shaddal, there's a really good online page called Shaddal Online. It has a nice long collection of things you can click, and it's right there. You will not find his Perush on Kohelet there, because it was not published as a standalone work or even in a collection of his works on Tanakh. It was published in a publication called Otsar Nechmat. That's not a book that he wrote. It was a publication. So it's kind of hidden in there. I looked at it today. It's an interesting parish. It's not terribly long. I would say it's less than 100 pages. Oh, there, you got it. Is that the Basi edition that you have there? Okay, yeah, it was recently reprinted. So yes, it does now exist. I haven't had it in my hands yet. Anyway, this parish is controversial in a way, because he was convinced that Kohelet was not Shlomo. He was convinced that this was a book that was written many generations, actually, after the time of Shlomo. One little piece of his reasoning I copied down here was the author introduces himself as Melech B'Yerushalayim, which is an odd phraseology. Why would Shlomo have called himself that? Shaddal was of the opinion that Shlomo would not have called himself that. He would have called himself Melech Yisrael. On the other hand, the person who wrote this book many years later would have found that expression confusing to his audience, because they would have thought that by then you had the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Yehuda. It would have sounded like he was the king of the northern kingdom. So this later writer called himself Melech B'Yerushalayim. It's just a small example of Shaddal's thought on this. Shaddal also, at least in his earlier writings on Kohelet, found the whole book rather disturbing, because there are these contradictions, which everybody knows about. There are sentiments in the book that seem to go against anything else that you find in Tanakh. And Shaddal was not terribly happy with that. In fact, he expressed the opinion that maybe it should never have been included in Tanakh in the first place. In later years, he softened that opinion and found value in what there was in Kohelet. But to my knowledge, he never did change his opinion that it was not really by Shlomo.
Right, I don't think so. In the new edition, like you alluded to, and we'll discuss it, Basi's edition, he does include some letters from him. He definitely softened his opinion on that. It is a nice pirush. It has a lot of like very mussary. It's very a lot of like his kind of like the way that his thought is a lot. And people wouldn't be maybe familiar with that. And he has a very nice epilogue in there where he goes through like the way, the proper way to live life. And he seems to hakol havel. He's very into it. It's actually very beautiful, the epilogue that he signs off at the end.
I did glance at that epilogue, yes.
Yeah, it's very nice. He wrote it when he was very young, I think he said, and he only published it later. It's very different than a lot of his regular Chumash stuff. It's not that style at all. It's very, very different. So it's worth looking at. Okay, so I think something that you alluded to that's from his most important works is Ayav Ger, his work that he wrote on Unglis. So I think that's definitely worth highlighting and discussing, which is, you know, what he did there in that work.
Okay. Ayav Ger, I have a copy here that I had printed for myself from a bookstore in Brooklyn years ago. I think it might have been Beagle Eyes. It's a wonderful book explaining what made Unglis tick. He divided his analysis into several different categories. One of his first observations was, I'm going to say something that may be shocking to some people. It may be something you've never heard before, but it needs to be said, and it's true. And that is, Onkelos did not write his Targum for the Chachamim. He wrote it for the Hedyotot, the common people. And what was his goal? His goal was to make the Torah, the Tanakh, understandable and palatable and acceptable to people who might find some of the original wording of the Tanakh a little bit hard to understand, a little misleading. He wanted to keep people focused on what the Torah and the Tanakh really meant. Here's an example. Some of the expressions in the Torah are what we call anthropomorphisms. They make it sound as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a body, a hand, a head, body parts. Some people have no problem with that. Others were disturbed by that. And so others, Onkelos apparently felt, might have been misled by such expressions. So he modified the wording in many instances. And I have an example here where it says that Noach, after the Mabul brought a carbon, it says, Vayarach Hashem et Reach HaNichoach. God smelled the delicious aroma of the carbon. Did he really? Is that a figure of speech? Is that going to mislead some people, some of the less sophisticated ones? So Onkelos changed that. The way he translated was, V'kabel Hashem b'rava yat karbanei. Hashem accepted with favor or with grace his carbon, completely eliminating any physical implications that there was a smell, that God liked the smell. He completely got out of that physical realm and made it into more of a spiritual pasuk. That's the kind of thing, according to Shadal, that Onkelos did again and again. As far as I know, it's still considered a fairly important work on Onkelos. There have been obviously others since then, but if you look at it and read it, it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's very useful to understanding Onkelos.
I believe he also has in there different textual variants. He went through the Gersois, right? He went through old various Svarim and Kisviadis as well. I think that he put in there also.
Yes, that's part of Ohav Ger. Shadal was very, very attuned to the right reading of the sources. He was very aware of old manuscripts, some of which he was able to get for himself, some of which he borrowed from others or had others send him excerpts. He wanted to know what these original best readings were. He did that a lot with Rashi also. If you read his Perush, all of his Perushim, he loved Rashi. He was a great admirer of Rashi, but he was very eager to know what was the best text of Rashi. He pored over the old manuscripts and said, this reading is actually better than what we have. And what's interesting is the Chevel edition of Rashi, which is one of the best scholarly editions, very often will have the readings that he had. Getting back to Onkelos, yes, the variations that he found in manuscripts from Italy, from other parts of Europe, were very much a part of his analysis of what Onkelos really meant to say.
Right. Okay. So a couple of other works you mentioned, we won't go more in depth on, but there's one more that you haven't mentioned that we'll get to. For the people I'm sure that are expecting it, we'll get there. But first, I want to discuss we'll get much more in depth. Nechomish, I just think right now in his biography, it's worth mentioning he wrote something called Beis HaYitzer, I think, which is kind of related to the Chumash, and there was the Chumash that was published, I think it was after he died even. So just talk a little bit, a general overview of, just talk a little bit about those.
Okay. Beis HaYitzer, or Beit HaYitzer, I get very Ashkafardic, you'll have to pardon me, was a sort of a miscellany. It was a book that contained all kinds of different things, some of which had appeared in other places. It contained elements of Parshanut, elements of Dikduk, some of Shadal's poetry, some historical investigations, a lot of different things in there, but many of them are found in other places as well. This book came out in 1847. One charming little thing about it is it's not divided into like sections or parts. It's divided into lishkot, chambers. It's the treasure house with chambers in it. So that's a kind of a nice way of dividing up a book. One important part of Beit HaYitzer, which I quoted at length in my introduction to Shemot, is his approach to the history of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, which we can get into in more detail a little bit later. But that's one thing that appears in Beit HaOtzar. Then we have the Chumash itself. It was put together in several stages and in several pieces. Early in his career, when he was teaching at the Collegio Rabbinico, he apparently, from what we now know from Yonatan Bassi, who put together one of the latest editions of Shaddal, apparently he wrote out for himself an entire version of what he was going to lecture to his students, and that was his perush. And his students, either during class or maybe before or maybe after, copied down these notes very carefully. And they evolved over the years. What we now have access to is manuscripts showing, in particular, there were two brothers who were at the Collegio, an older brother and a younger brother. The older brother was there first. He unfortunately died young, but then his younger brother came to the Collegio and resumed the family's place there. He took the notes that his brother had taken, and we can see that he made erasures, crossing out, adding notes in, because Shaddal was always changing his perush. His thoughts always were growing and developing. And so this is a good indication of what the process was, these manuscripts that we now have. In the 1840s, he was induced, a publisher asked him to write or collect some of his perushim on the Torah. He put them together, and this was called Hamish Tadel. Hamish Tadel is a pun because it's based on the letter Shaddal. Mishtadel is somebody who makes an effort, a striver, an endeavorer. And that's sort of a name that he took on for himself. This book, Hamishtadel, is a fairly short book. It's by no means an all-inclusive perush on the Torah, but it's like highlights from what he had of notes for his students. Later on in his career, apparently he felt that it was time to revise this and come out with a more definitive version. Unfortunately, he never lived to do that. It was up to his students and probably some of his sons, who put together what notes they could find from his students and made a more thorough edition of his perush in Hebrew. Now, meanwhile, he had also written an Italian translation of the text. The Italian translation came out, I think, in 1858. It was not originally meant to be printed together with the Hebrew perush. It was meant for a different audience, really. The Italian translation of the Torah text, from what I can tell, was meant for the Italian Jewish public. The Italian Jewish public, interesting to note at this point, was not swayed by reform, as they were getting to be over the mountains in Germany, nor were they terribly observant anymore. This was the era of emancipation. The Italian non-Jewish public was fairly accepting of the Jews. It took them a while for them to get political rights, but once they did, the Jews were very quick to join public life, to get into politics, to get into other professions. They were not terribly keen on being terribly observant anymore, but they were not keen on reform either. The shul they didn't go to was an Orthodox shul, to put it that way. So it was for this public that Shaddal wrote his Italian translation. He wanted it to be accessible to all. He wanted everybody to understand what the Torah was saying. Not quite the same as his Hebrew perush, which was written for his students who were studying to be rabbis. It's not always easy to understand what the perush says. His Hebrew is absolutely beautiful and wonderful. An Italian rabbi once described his Hebrew as limpidissimo, very, very clear. It is beautiful. He has a beautiful Hebrew writing style, but sometimes he gets a little cryptic. Sometimes he will say, to understand this pasuk, look at Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, look at Sefer HaZikaron, look at the Mishnah here, look at the Mishnah there, and he won't explain what he means. Apparently, his original audience, which was his rabbinical students, would have understood what he was talking about. If they didn't, they probably had a library that they could easily look up what he was talking about. But this was not as conducive for a general broad public as his Italian translation. So to jump a little bit ahead, this is what I've had to do as a translator of the Perush and the translation of Italian, putting it all together, adding footnotes where I need to flesh out what Shadal was trying to say in a very brief way. Okay, I think I've answered part of your question there. Where do we go from here?
I think you answered it very well. And I just want to give the listeners and give everyone listening just a general overview of him as a whole. And we're going to dive into your work in the Chumash more. Just discussing him takes some time. And the final work that we have to discuss, I guess no discussion of Shadal is complete without it, is his famous, infamous, his Vikuach. I don't know what exactly the proper, I don't have it in front of Vikuach.
Kabbalah.
Yeah, so again, it sounds like Vikuach against Kabbalah, but what exactly was it? Why did he write it? Just a brief, we're not going to go in depth on that, that's not what the podcast is about, but just talk about it a little bit.
Okay, I'm actually doing a little bit of research into that now, and I'll explain later. When he was 13 years old, the same year that he was forced to discontinue his formal education, he was reading through Ein Yaakov, the collection of Agados from the Talmud, and began to notice, he formed the opinion from what he was reading, that there were no written Nekudot and Ta'amim at the time of the Talmud. Yes, there was a way of... There was a nigun, there was an accepted way of understanding how the words went together, but from what he could see, from what he was reading, there were no written systems of Nekudot and Ta'amim until after the time of the Talmud. Now, this presents a problem when you try to understand the Zohar, because the book of Zohar apparently not only mentions the Ta'amim and the Nekudot by name, but derives mystical teachings from them. This presented a problem to Shadal. He decided that if these systems did not exist in the time of the Talmud, the Zohar must be a forgery. And he wrote at a fairly young age a very interesting short work called Vikuach al Chochmat HaKabbalah. It was presented as a debate between two students. It reads very interestingly. They meet at a Hoshana Rabbah all night learning session, and one of them is a devotee of Kabbalah, the other one is not, and the one who is not presents the arguments why one should not believe that the Zohar is what people claim it is, and in the end, as far as I understand, he wins over the opinion of the other person. For a long time, Shadal decided this was not something he wanted to publish because he was afraid of harming the simple faith of Frumma Yidden. He wrote it, I believe, in the 1820s. In 1852, he had decided, he was more a mature scholar, he decided that the harm that he saw coming from Kabbalah outweighed any harm that might be caused by his publishing his work, and so he published it. Yes.
I think he even published it like in honor of like a Talmud, a student's chasen or something funny. I seem to remember, I don't know.
Yeah, he dedicated it in honor of one of his younger colleagues' wedding, yes. This created a very interesting controversy with the other leading scholar of Italy at the time, Rav Elia ben Amozeg, who's not as well known, I think, as Shadal, but a very interesting character. He was from a different school of thought. He was from a Moroccan family. They were very much devoted to Kabbalah. By the way, Shadal's father was also very much into Kabbalah, and it kind of hurt his father that Shadal had turned aside from that. But Ben-Amazegh never turned away. He, in his youth, he says he began to challenge Kabbalah, but then came back to it in a very thorough way. Ben-Amazegh took 10 years to write a book in opposition to the Vikuach. In 1862, it came out. And at that point, a very interesting series of letters between Shaddal and Ben-Amazegh were written. And that's what I'm working on right now. I'm taking a break after Vayikra and between Vayikra and Bamidbar to write about this very interesting exchange of letters. I won't give away too much about it, but I'm hoping to have it published in a Jewish publication fairly soon. It's entertaining. It retains relevance because they get into all kinds of issues about Judaism and nationalism, about, you know, can you have Kabbalah without the Zohar? Very interesting things. That's in a nutshell what that's about.
Where can those letters be found?
Ah, not easy. They can be found in Italian. The collection of Shaddal's Italian letters, the Epistolario, has the letters that he wrote. Ben-Amazegh collected his letters to Shaddal in another collection called Lettere. And you really have to splice together the letters in these two different books to see what their correspondence was like. This was done in the 1930s by an Italian rabbi. He wrote an article describing this correspondence. He republished this article, interestingly, after the war. And it's that article, those two articles, that I have drawn upon basically to present this whole controversy in English for the very first time. And they left out parts of the letters. You can't print them all because they get into other things, they get off the subject. Ben-Amazegh in particular was very wordy, and you have to kind of abridge what he wrote. But the exchange of letters is fascinating, and I'm almost done with it.
Fascinating. So first of all, just to mention that Shaddal, that he discusses the Nekudas and the Taimim, I think that they didn't exist at the time of the Gemara. That opinion, that sheet is really Yo Bacher, Elijah Levita's opinion, I think in Maseiras Maseir, and he does try to make it fit with desire, but you know, that's where it comes from. Anyone wants to know about it, they can look it up. He's the one who first proponent of that. Now, the other thing that I want, right, and mainly the Vikuach is really, it's against the Zohar, but right, against the Zohar being Shem Baruch Hai, but okay, we'll leave all of that aside. That's just, there is a new edition of it also published by Yonatan Bassi that's right. Available. I mean, it's not like, it's just as an introduction. It's not, there's no like notes or anything. It's just like a new print and that there's a new edition available. The other thing I guess we wanted to just finish up before we get in is just Shaddal's relationship with other various scholars and in Europe. I know he had a relationship with Shir, Shlomi Yehuda Rappaport, Chief Rabbi of Prague. And there was also, we should mention Yitzchak Morizio Yashar, the other one who also wrote a Pirush and Chumash with an Italian translation and a Hebrew Pirush as well.
Yes. Okay, well, first there's Shir, Rav Rappaport. Rappaport was older than Shaddal, but Shaddal approached him when he was quite young, when Shaddal was quite young, and because he admired what he was doing. He was, the two of them might be called Orthodox Maskilim. They believed in a sort of an academic approach to Jewish studies, but they were personally from, and they looked askance at people who were doing academic Jewish studies and not from. For many years, they had a correspondence. They had a falling out eventually because they had a difference of opinion on, in particular, the Rambam and Ibn Ezra. Shir Rappaport was a very great admirer of the Rambam and of Ibn Ezra. Shaddal, not so much. He admired Rambam to some extent, but he was very much, he had a lot of trouble with the Rambam's involvement in Greek philosophy, which Shaddal had no use for whatsoever. His problem with Ibn Ezra was he thought he was insincere. He thought he was, his writing style was cryptic. He didn't always say what he meant. And he took a dislike to him. So this became a bone of contention between Shaddal and Rappaport. Eventually, Shaddal said, okay, this is it. I'm writing you a get. We are no longer friends, and that's it. It took several years and some going between friends of theirs, mutual friends of theirs. Eventually, they reconciled, at least to some extent, and for many more years, they had a correspondence. But Rappaport said at one point, I understand where you're coming from because you come from a torrid land and you have a torrid temperament. But, you know, try to control it. Shaddal wasn't always able to control that. I mean, he would say very barbed, pointed things about people. He would say about the more assimilated or academic Jewish scholars who were no longer observant, he would say, what business does this man have touching this book? Would he have never even picked it up to look at it? His real spiritual enemy was Spinoza. Spinoza lived, of course, several hundred years before him, but he was totally opposed to Spinoza's philosophy of determinism as he saw it. He felt that if you follow Spinoza's philosophy, it means that there's nothing anyone can do to improve the world. Things are the way they are because they have to be. There's no God as we understand it who can change anything. He says, this is Spinozism. Its exact opposite is Judaism. It's one of his spiritual enemies. I've mentioned his correspondence with Ben Amozeg. Very interesting. Ben Amozeg, even though he wrote a whole book against Shaddal's approach to the Kabbalah, kept saying, but we need to be friends. Why can't we be friends? And Shaddal kept saying, you want to be my friend? You keep attacking me. You want to be, okay, I'll be your friend in the sense that I'm a friend of people who I always tell you the exact truth. If that's what you want, I'll be your friend. It's what I find very interesting about their correspondence. Shaddal was in close, yes?
I just wanted to jump in before we get to Origio. I think just to finish up with Rappaport, I think maybe he's an interesting figure to talk about one day, but Rappaport, Shlomi Yehuda Rappaport will be very familiar to a lot of listeners because he was the son-in-law of the Ksais HaChoshen, which is so he was his son-in-law of the author of the Ksais, and he also was the Magia, was the editor of the Avne Meluim. So anybody using an Avne Meluim, the Magia was Shlomi Yehuda Rappaport, just interestingly enough, that people may be familiar with him that way.
Okay. All right. Reggio is an interesting figure in Shaddal's life. Yitzchak Reggio was a leading Italian rabbi of his day, older than Shaddal. In some ways, he was more non-traditional than Shaddal. He was a very close follower of Mendelssohn. Now, Mendelssohn, of course, is a loaded name. If you look at Reggio's own Italian translation of the Torah, which he wrote some years before Shaddal's, it's almost exactly the same as Mendelssohn's. It's an Italian, almost like an Italian translation of Mendelssohn's German version of the Torah. His parish also, Reggio wrote a Hebrew parish just like Shaddal did. He wrote an Italian translation, a Hebrew parish. To my knowledge, they are the only two people who ever did a European translation and a Hebrew parish all by themselves. Mendelssohn did not do that. He had editors and contributors. But Reggio, if you want to know what he thought, basically almost always the same as what Mendelssohn thought in his parish. And yet they were very close colleagues, Shaddal and Reggio. Reggio was responsible for having Shaddal hired as one of these two professors at the Collegio Rabbinico. And so Shaddal really owed him a lot. He owed him his entire livelihood. They maintained a close relationship really to the end of Reggio's life. He was the one who died first. Many other Jewish scholars of the day Frum or not Frum, were correspondents of Chedal. They wanted his help to find old manuscripts, to give them advice about what does this word mean, what does that word mean. Chedal was very happy to cooperate with them. He cooperated with people like Leopold Zuntz, Jost, who was one of the first Jewish historians of the modern era. He didn't agree at all with their religious philosophy. He was very angry with them for following the academic approach. He accused them of loving the ancient Greek and Roman classics just as much as they did the Tanaim and Amoraim. He said they're not in it for the right reason. They're in this kind of scholarship for personal glory. It's a shame that they don't value the Jewish tradition as a living tradition anymore. And very interestingly, I found a quote by Shimshon Raphael Hirsch very much to that same sentiment. He said, the tears of our ancestors no longer fill our breasts, but our libraries. That's very much the same sentiment that Chedal was trying to express.
Right. Okay, so now I think we went in depth enough on Chedal's life and his works. So I think we should talk a little bit about his Chumash and your work translating it and the works that you have put out and you are continuing to publish. So we discussed his Chumash overall, but I think first maybe it would be good to mention what exactly his Chumash exactly set out to do, the current one, what exactly it does, what type of, I'm trying to think of the right way, what type of questions does he tackle and what is Pirish exactly, what style it is, so to speak. And then we'll get into what you did.
Okay. I think the best way to explain it is I always tell people, if you want to look for an inspiring Dvar Torah for your Shabbos table, you won't often find that in Chedal. If you want to know what this word means, you will find that in Chedal. He's very much into the pshat. He's very much into what these words mean. His great talent was finding connections between words in totally different parts of Tanakh and bringing them together and comparing them. He would also make fine distinctions between synonyms in Hebrew and explain why this is a little bit different from that. His biographer, Rabbi Margolis, was convinced that he knew the entire Tanakh by heart. In an age long before computer memory banks, this was an incredible skill to have, and he put it to good use. He was able to remember a word that he saw someplace in Tehillim and bring it back in and relate it to where it occurs in somewhere in like Bereshis. He was not so much into explaining, what lessons we learn from this story or that story. Sometimes he does. At the end of the story of Adam and Chava, he says, why is this here? What does this teach us? Which is a little bit unusual for him to do, but he has an interesting theory. He says, really, the Eitz Hadas was not something that was forced upon anybody, was not something that was just chanced upon. People, as they were created, had this intellect. And sometimes people complain that our intellect causes us all kinds of problems. If we only were more like animals, we would have much simpler lives. But Chedal says people, when they think about it a little bit more, realize that no, it's not really good to be just an animal with no intellect. This is a trade-off we've made. We want to be intelligent. We want to not just operate by instinct. And this is something that we would not want to change. So what he says is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a way, set us up. He said, okay, here's a tree. If you eat from it, you'll become wise. Don't eat that. And the temptation was too great. They ate it. They were punished. Many troubles came from this intellectual ability that they got from that. But in the end, people would not want to be any different. And that is the story of the Eitz HaDaat. That's why it's presented the way it is. It's a little bit unusual for him to be getting into that kind of thing, but his parish does contain certain things like that. In Vayikra, which I've just finished translating, he gets into overviews of what some of the halachas are in Vayikra, like, for instance, Tzaraat. What's that? Almost any other parish you read will say, well, of course, this is a punishment for Lashon Hara. Shadal doesn't say that. What he says is the people at the time felt when they saw some skin disfigurement on a person, they probably assumed this was because it was a reproach from God for having done something wrong. He doesn't say Lashon Hara. He says something wrong probably caused this in the popular imagination. If you saw a house with a discoloration, you would think something terrible happened in that house. He says this is not necessarily the truth, but the halachas were set up in such a way as to reinforce that belief, because he doesn't use the term necessary belief, but I think that's what he's getting at. The term necessary belief means something that is good for people to believe, even if it's not literally true. And in several instances, that's what Shadal uses to explain certain bodies of halacha. He said, Tzaraat, all these rules about diagnosing and separating yourself and only coming back out when you're cured, this was a way to reinforce the popular idea that, yes, there was something you did wrong. Hashem is angry with you, and something needs to be done about that. But as I said, mostly he focuses on what this word means, what's the shoresh. He didn't have access to some of the more modern bodies of knowledge like Ugaritic or Akkadian. I think Akkadian was just being discovered at the end of his life. Ugaritic didn't come out until the 1920s, but he paid very close attention to Aramaic. He paid some attention to Arabic. He was a scholar of Syriac, which is a dialect of Aramaic, and he examined those cognate languages to Hebrew to figure out what some of the Hebrew words mean. He was very attuned to that kind of scholarship.
Right, I think those are all obviously unique things about his pirish, like grammar, like you just alluded to. Also, I mean, I've found that he is, in certain instances, into history, historically, what was this place and what was this about? I mean, you could talk a little bit about that, the history that's included in there. And also, we should mention the people that he quotes and the languages that he quotes in. I know in Bassi's new edition, it has, you know, there's long blocks of quote in Italian, Latin, Greek, Egyptian. It's got like he spoke many languages, you know, and he quoted, you know, and who he quoted also. He wasn't only quoting, you know, old, you know, Rishonim and early Achronim, which he was also quoting scholars and other things as well. So I guess talk about those two things.
Yeah, that's an important aspect of his work. I wrote at the end of my volumes a whole list of his sources. Many of them are the sources you would expect to see, Rashi, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Ramban. Interestingly, he had many negative things to say about Ibn Ezra, but he quoted him very, very often. And I made a tabulation I wrote the index to these volumes. And to break up the long, long series of numbers of pages where he quotes Ibn Ezra, I decided to make it more interesting. I divided it up between instances where he agrees and instances where he doesn't agree. And at least in Sefer Shemos, it comes out almost even though he has all these negative things to say about Ibn Ezra. So he was willing to accept the truth where he found it. That was the main principle of his scholarship. So he quoted all these usual kinds of people. He also quoted ancient Greek and Roman sources because he felt that sometimes they had bearing on what was going on. He would explain some of the geographical names and locations by referring to ancient geographers and scholars. But he didn't stop there. He quoted medieval, early church fathers, medieval authorities, modern non-Jewish scholars of his time. He was very dependent on one in particular, Rosenmüller of Germany. I didn't realize how much until I actually looked at Rosenmüller's own work and said, oh, this all sounds familiar. Because Chadal does lean rather heavily on him at times. Rosenmüller was what you might call a conservative Christian scholar. This was just in the days when the beginnings of the critical theory were happening. Chadal was aware of the theories that there were more than one source of the Torah, the more than one author. He was very much opposed to those theories. He very much believed in Torah Min HaShemayim, that the Torah we have was written by Moshe. But he was attuned to what was going on outside him in the non-Jewish, non-traditional biblical world of scholarship. He accepted their opinions where he found them acceptable and fought them fiercely when he did not. But he did not shy away from engaging with these scholars. A lot of the scholars he quotes are Huguenots from the 16 and 1700s. These are French Protestants who were persecuted in France, found their way to Holland and taught there. He quotes Dutch scholars of that era also, who were all, again, were very traditional in a way. They were Christian Hebraists. They were Christians, but who were very attuned and interested in understanding what the Hebrew words were. And Chadal was very happy to accept their scholarship when he felt it had something to contribute.
Right, I can't find it. I was looking, I know he, one point, he won this, and he quotes, he said all these interesting sources that Jacinius also, he quotes a lot. And he, one point, I forget who it was, he's quoting, he's like, listen to this Kaifer, how he's talking about the Torah, but he was like all upset, he's bent out of shape about it. But there are times he quotes obviously very interesting sources that would not be conventional and people would be uncomfortable with seeing. So that is something that's interesting. So obviously that's all something that's unique about his Chumash. So you, like you said, you took it upon yourself, you translated Bereishis Shemais, and now you're doing Vayikra. I think what's obviously very, very important we should talk about is, your work on his translation. So as you said, you translated the translation, his Italian translation into English, and you have the Pirush in English as well. So I'll just say this. What's interesting is the Pasuk, you don't have it in Hebrew, so you have the Pasuk, we'll say the Perek and the Pasuk, the numbers, and then the bold is all his translation, translated. People might not be familiar. And then you will have, in English, his actual Pirush. So what went into translating the translation, and talk about, we alluded to it earlier, talk a little bit more about the translation and what is unique and somebody can take out of that. And then we will get to the Pirush as well, what went into doing that, and what, we'll talk about that.
Okay, well, when I first started this project, when I was in my 20s, I had the intuition that it would be a good idea to translate the translation from Italian. I didn't quite understand why completely in my youth. I had this vague idea that, well, one translation is pretty much like another. When I found out that Reggio had also written an Italian translation of the Torah, I thought, well, why did Chadal bother writing his own? But when you become a little bit more sophisticated about Bible translations, you realize that each one of them is very different. Each one of them really functions as a parish in and of itself. Because when you try to tell people from another language what this original text means, you can't help but interpret as you go along. Not only is that true of any translation, but Chadal, in his Italian translation, stuck in phrases in brackets where he thought something was not completely understandable. And so the audience that he was writing for, the general Italian Jewish public, should be able to understand a little bit more than just what the translation was. And here's an example. Here's why I think it's important for the Italian translation to be brought to the public's attention in English. In Vayikra, his Hebrew parish is a little bit sparser than it is for Bereishis and Shemos. Sometimes the only way you will know what Chadal thinks something means is by reading his text translation in Italian. And here's an example. In Vayikra, where it talks about bringing the Omer, he has nothing in his Hebrew Perush about what Omer means. It's not entirely clear what the word Omer means. But in his Italian translation, his translation of the word Omer is manipolo, which means sheaf. And then he has a bracketed comment after that. According to the tradition, a measure of barley, barley grain of this, which comes from that sheaf, the manipolo. So he's, instead of writing a Hebrew perush on that word, he's saying what he wants to say right in the body of his translation. And I make a note in my Vayikra that Rav David Hoffman, David Zvi Hoffman, who wrote his own perush on Vayikra later, fairly often does refer to Shaddal. And when he comes to the word Omer, says, this is what Shaddal says it means literally, and this is what he says it means according to tradition. The only reason that Rav Hoffman was able to understand what Shaddal thought about the word Omer was reading his translation, because there was no perush. And that's one reason why I thought it was important to present both elements of what Shaddal did. So as I translated the Italian translation, in a way it was made a little bit easier because we have the original Hebrew. We have all kinds of English translations of the Hebrew. So translating the Italian into English, I tried to be to stay as close as I could to what Shaddal was saying in Italian, but I also kept an eye on the original Hebrew in case things got a little bit unclear. So I had my eye on two different things at least when I was translating the Italian into English. I tried to make it as smooth as I could. Sometimes it might sound a little bit stilted, but I didn't want to depart too far from what Shaddal was trying to do in Italian. Translating the Hebrew, as I mentioned, in some ways it was a pleasure and a breeze because his Hebrew, for the most part, is very clear, very beautiful, wonderful style. But as I mentioned, sometimes it gets a little cryptic. Sometimes he says things in a very brief way. He alludes to things that the modern reader might have no idea what he's talking about. And so it was part of my job, I thought, and part of the enjoyment of the job, to find out what he was talking about. In the old days, it meant going to libraries, like I went to the YU library, I went to the New York Public Library's Jewish division. I had the privilege of going to the what's now called the National Library of Israel several times. I had a wonderful session in Philadelphia, what used to be the Dropsy College Library is now owned by the University of Pennsylvania. They have a beautiful library in downtown Philadelphia. And I was taken in hand there by one of the scholars there, and he helped me understand what some of the abbreviations were that Shaddal used. They gave me a table with all kinds of books to look at. It was a wonderful experience. That was then. Now, almost all of that stuff is online. There's much less of a reason to have to go to a library, and it's, in a way, it's less fun because you don't have these old relics in your hand and reading what, you know, having something in your hand that maybe Shaddal had in his hand. On the other hand, it's also a kind of a different kind of thrill to know what link to go to. Click on the link and there it is right in front of your eyes. I will say, living here in Rochester, New York, it would have been very, very hard for me to complete what I had to do in the amount of time that I've done without having to go out of town back to New York or wherever to go to libraries. So this new wonderful modern age of the internet has made my job much easier.
Right. So I know we've touched on this, but perhaps speak about it. I know we're starting Shemais now. So I mean, we'll see when this is actually released, but when we're recording it. So talk a little bit about, you mentioned some in Vayikra, but I don't, so you can mention some more, but we haven't mentioned a lot in Shemay, some unique Perushim of his, some interesting, you know, things that he mentions in Shemais that you enjoy translating and that you...
Okay. My favorite part of his Perush on Shemos is the Shir HaSayam. He gets into wonderful explanations about, first of all, he gets into a whole explanation about what is parallelism, you know, Tikbolet, why phrases are repeated, what you get from that, how it becomes more poetic. He talks about why things are sometimes written in the singular when actually it seems like it should have been the plural, like sus v'rochvo rama v'yam, horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. Obviously there are many horses and many riders. Why didn't the Moshe just say the horses and the riders were thrown into the sea? Shadal explains that it's much better poetry to talk about one figure, one person, one instance, because that concentrates the mind more on, oh, there was this rider and he fell into the water. This horse fell into the water. The example that I think of from the modern world is, why did the Diary of Anne Frank become so popular? It's because if you talk about 6 million people, it's a little bit hard to get a handle on that. But if you think about one young girl and what she in person suffered and what she underwent, makes it much more real to the reader. And I think that's what Shadal was trying to get at, and saying that this is why poets use the singular instead of the plural. One of my favorite things he says in the explaining Shirat Tayam is the word yichasyumu. The water has covered them, yichasyumu. It's a very unusual word when you think about it. It has no parallel anywhere else. Shadal says, well, you know, really it should have been something like yichasemo or yichasem or yichasum. Why is it yichasyumu? What's that all about? And the answer that he gives is, it's onomatopoeia. It expresses the idea of, here we are drowning in a depth of water, yachasyumu. He says that oo sound expresses something that would not be expressed otherwise. The word yechasemo with an o wouldn't be the same thing. Yechasyum with one u wouldn't have been the same thing. Yechasyumu is the way to express this very gloomy feeling. And I dropped a footnote here. It works in English too, because you have the expression doom and gloom. You have the Edgar Allan Poe poem, Yulalum. It's the same phenomenon exists in more than one language. And so I think he was onto something there. That's the kind of thing I really enjoy about his parish on Shir HaSayam in particular.
Very interesting. I did want to tie up two loose ends from before. First of all, you mentioned Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, so he does quote him as well. He was the author of Melamed L'Hoyl. He was a big place in Germany before the war. Also, Aksava Kabbalah, Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, very famous Pirish, quotes Shadal extensively throughout his Pirish as well. And there are others, but just, you know, some that quote him as well.
If that's worth noting, it's also worth noting that Nechama Leibovitz gets into him as well. She not only quotes him often, but will challenge her readers to say, well, what do you think? Is he right? Is he wrong? And sometimes she will express her own opinion. You know, he missed the mark here. And sometimes I think she's wrong, and I will drop a footnote and explain why I think she was wrong about it. But she was very much involved. She was very attuned to Shadal and was aware of his parish and used it often.
Right. And something else I realized that I don't think we covered exactly. I brought up before, then we got off into the sources about that he sometimes discusses historically, you know, where certain places were, when certain events, you know, happened. He does get into that. And you do speak about like the uniqueness of the Pirish in that way, how he does sometimes, you know, get into stuff like that.
Okay. Well, again, this was one of the things he used ancient scholarship for. When he was, here's an interesting thing. Where was Ur Kasdim? Most people assume that it was down toward the Persian Gulf, at the end of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. That's the mainstream opinion. There's a problem with that, though, because if you try to map Avraham's wanderings over the years, that location for Ur doesn't really fit in. It would make more sense to say that Ur was more in the neighborhood of Haran. Haran was in not in southeast Mesopotamia or Iraq nowadays. It was in northwest Mesopotamia. And he relies on logic to put forth this theory, but he also relies on a Roman historian who refers to various place names, and he doesn't, I don't think he says Ur, but he relies on Roman history to buttress his opinion where Ur was. And again, one of the fun things about this project was dropping footnotes. I found modern scholarship that also takes that opinion, that there might have been another Ur. I mean, there definitely was an Ur that was found by archaeologists in the southeast. There may have been another Ur, maybe named after that one, in the northwest. And again, some modern scholars after the time of Shaddal agree that this would simplify the story greatly if he didn't have to travel down there and up there and make the story more complicated. So this is the kind of scholarship that he used to buttress his opinion.
Okay, so I think Vayikra we've mentioned. I mean, if you want to talk about anything else from your forthcoming Vayikra that's interesting, yeah, you can mention that as well. Something that I do just want to point out before that is that, first of all, each volume contains an index, like you alluded to earlier. And also, which is nice, is that each volume contains the list of the sources that he's quoting and who they were, which is, you don't have to refer back to Bereshis to check it out. You know, you have it in Bereshis Shmos, and I assume it'll be in Vayikra, so you can check that out. You know, who was this person? Because sometimes he quotes these maybe obscure sources to a lot of readers as well. So I guess if you want to mention something else in Vayikra, and also introductions, you know, did you just include one introduction each one, or just stay, or each Bereshis Shmos and Vayikra are going to have different introductions? And just, I think, talk about each one. You know, what was your introduction discussing in each volume? I think that's important to discuss.
Okay, well, just to get back to the list of sources first, I thought it was important to list these people because some of them are people that we just have never heard of before in this day and age. Some of them we may have heard the names, but don't really quite understand when they lived or what they did. And to me, it was also important to do this because to compare my work with some other Shaddal work that's been done. The first reprinting of Shaddal's Perush since the time of the 1870s when it first came out, was done in Israel in the 1960s. That brought back Shaddal to public attention, at least in Israel. The problem was it did not have the Italian text translation in Hebrew or in English. It just didn't have the text at all. It just had the Perush. Made the book a little bit hard to use on its own. The other sin that they committed, as far as I'm concerned, is that very often when Shaddal quoted somebody untraditional or not Jewish, they would delete the name, sometimes delete even the comment, and just kind of smooth over it. And they would say sometimes, well, some say this, without giving the name. And in the introduction to that edition from Israel in the 1960s, the explanation was given, well, we don't want to bother people with these names that they never heard of. And my reaction is, not only does this take away the flavor and the full scholarship of what Shaddal was trying to do, it would have been just as easy and preferable to make a list of the sources and explain who they were. And that's what I did. So that.
And I want to jump in.
Is the reason I did.
I just wanted to jump in. Yes. Sorry, not to cut you off. That the Monk edition, Monk translated in four volumes, not only Monk sometimes paraphrases and doesn't quote, you know, doesn't, I think he says this, doesn't word for word, but he also used that faulty edition, so to speak. I believe it's been proved. So, you know, in his translation, you're going to, I'm not saying this to knock his translation, I think it's a nice work, just to point out that, so you will be missing a decent amount of stuff, is my understanding.
That is true. And that's something that I really lucked into having the grandmother that I did, having the great grandfather that I did, inheriting these books from them, I worked with the full text of Chagall. I did not work from the 1960s edition that had these leave-outs. It became obvious to me as I went on and became aware of the Israeli edition that I really done the right thing in going back to the original. In my latest work, I've also become aware of some of the manuscripts that exist in Israel, in New York, and I've been trying to include some of the elements of those manuscripts. I haven't included everything because that would, as I point out in one of my introductions, it would have been really writing a whole new book. But when I see something that's interesting that didn't make it into the 1870s edition of Chagall's work, I bring it in and explain sometimes why perhaps it wasn't included in the 1870s edition, the first printing, how it differs from what he said in other points of his career. So that's another point of interest. So you had many questions and I'm trying to answer all of them, but go on.
No, it's my fault. I shouldn't have lumped them all together. So getting back to, I wanted to ask you, and I think this is the case, that your introduction to Bereishis and Shemais, I think, are different, and Vayikra will be different. It's not just one introduction. And if I'm right, which I think so, you know, what does each one, what are your introductions talk about in Bereishis and Shemais, and what are you going to be talking about in your Vayikra introduction?
Okay. My introduction to Bereishis, which was written first, gave a more complete overview of Chagall's own life and career than I did in the subsequent volumes. Also, what I felt had to be discussed at some length was the critique from the right and the critique from the left. Was Chagall too modern, or was he not modern enough? And so I get into a discussion of that. The more traditional scholars who don't like quoting outside sources, who don't like quoting people who weren't Jewish, might look askance at Chagall, and I defend him in that way. I mean, as I said before, he accepted the truth where he found it, and I think that's a very important approach to take. On the other hand, from the left, even in his own day, Chagall was attacked as being, well, his traditionalism is impeding his scholarship. If he was really intellectually honest, he would have said things that were much more radical. And I get into a whole discussion there about just how scientific is biblical criticism. Is it really a science? Is it something that has to be followed to certain conclusions? And I defend him on that ground. That was Bereishis. In Shemos, my introduction emphasized, in Shemos, of course, is where you get into much more detail of halacha, especially the parsha of Mishpatim. Chagall had a very interesting take on the development of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Some consider it outside the pale. Some consider it in conflict with Orthodox belief. I examined it very closely and decided that, no, there's room in the Orthodox tent for what Chagall was saying. If you want me to explain a little bit more, I will. Chagall was of the opinion that if you look at, again, of course, he was very much into the pshat. If it says in the pasuk that the Korban Pesach should be brought Bein Ha'arbayim, that means in the twilight time. However, the way the halacha developed, at least in later on, was that you were allowed to bring the Korban Pesach from the noon hour onward. There will be some Perushim who will try to convince you that that's what Bein Harbayim means. Chagall has none of that. He said, no, Bein Harbayim means at twilight, but what the Chachamim did was correct, because there came a time in Jewish history where there were so many Jews who had to get all of their korbanos taken care of in Yerushalayim at the same time. It would have been logistically impossible to get everyone's done at the twilight hour. So they were perfectly justified in bringing the time back to noon and onward. It doesn't mean that that's what Bein Harbayim means. It means that the Chachamim had the right to do what they did. He points to a particular pasuk in Devarim, which he says gives the Chachamim broad rights to do what they wanted. The pasuk is Devarim Yud Zayin Yud Aleph, Al Pi HaTorah Asher Yarucha, Bal HaMishpat Asher Yomru Lecha Ta'aseh. Whatever they tell you to do, you will do. Now, those who look askance at Shaddal for saying this sort of thing point to the scholars of what was then called in his day the positive historical school, which later developed into the conservative movement. Their position is that this remains true in every day and age. The rabbis of every period not only have the right, but have the obligation to change the halacha as society needs to have it changed. In my readings of what Shaddal said, I have come to the conclusion that Shaddal would not have agreed. He apparently was of the belief that there was a sort of a golden age of Chachamim who knew what the Torah meant, who were attuned to what the people needed, and legislated in that spirit. He looked upon what was happening in his own day, certainly in the reform movement. He didn't like the name reform. He thought it was a fake. This is not reform. This is totally abolishing halacha. He was not favorably disposed to some of the more modernizing rabbis of his time. He said what they were doing was trying to be popular. They were trying to gain favor in the public eye. They were trying to make things easier. They were not looking to the deep meaning of the Torah. They were not looking to what the Torah really meant. He compared them to babes and sucklings in comparison to the Chachamim of the golden age of when they really knew what they were doing. So that, I believe, is a very fundamental difference between him and the positive historical conservative approach. I think that's what keeps him in the Orthodox tent. And that's part of what I was talking about in my introduction to Shamos. I reworked that part of that introduction into an article that I submitted to the Rassegna Mensile di Israel, which is the leading Italian Jewish periodical. They recently began taking articles in English, and I thought, oh, wow, I should do this. So I submitted it to them. I had a great time emailing them back and forth in Italian. I don't actively use Italian very often, but in that case I did. And so I succeeded in having that printed a couple of years ago. So that's what I did for Shamos. Vayikra, I discuss some of the things that I've already mentioned, this overview of Tzarat, why those laws existed. What's interesting is he looks at Tuma and Tara, he looks at the Karbanos, and he sees in them social utility. These are laws, these are systems that were promulgated to help human society, Jewish society. It's not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu needed Karbanos or especially wanted Karbanos. He wanted us to think that he did, because that way is a way of reinforcing in our own minds that there is a HaKadosh Baruch Hu out there. He wants us to do certain things. He wants us to lead good and moral lives. And the whole system of Karbanos was a way of reinforcing that belief. One very interesting thing, he says that there's a seemingly finicky detail about when you bring a Karban Shlamim, it needs to be consumed within 2 days. After the third day, it's pigul, it's rejected, it's no good. The whole thing is as if you never brought a good karban. He says this too was for social utility, because what happens when you have this great big ox or whatever it is and you have to eat it up in 2 days? You can't do it yourself. You are not allowed to preserve it in salt and take it home with you from Yerushalayim and eat it whenever you want to in the next few months with your family. You need to eat that whole thing. And if necessary, and usually it will be necessary, you need to share it with others. Sometimes with strangers, sometimes with the poor. And this was a way, this rule of eating everything within the first 2 days was a way of social harmony, social cohesion, bringing people together. And this was something that I find very interesting in his approach to some of the laws of Vayikra. Another part of my introduction to Vayikra gets into a very controversial thing that has been held against Shaddai. In one of his letters to Rav Rapoport, who we mentioned before, he makes a very cryptic kind of remark about, you know, I don't like Ibn Ezra, as you know, but sometimes I accept what he says, and sometimes he'll say things that are against the halacha, and I will accept it anyway. Now, he didn't mean to say he will break the halacha. He said sometimes Ibn Ezra will say something against the halacha. But if you look at what that really means, what Ibn Ezra's system was and what Rashbam's system was to look into the Peshat, but not to say, well, that means that the halacha is wrong. That's not at all what they meant to say. Anyway, Shaddai says, yeah, Ibn Ezra says something about shaving. He says that it's only meant, according to the Peshat, as a mourning custom not to shave. And then he makes a very strange remark. He says, and so I have accepted in my personal practice, although I don't teach it to others because I'm not in the business of teaching halacha. Now, what on earth was he talking about? Did it mean that he shaved in a non-halachic manner? He doesn't say that. First of all, he doesn't even talk about shaving at all. He says, this pasuk that says, lo takifu, takifu at roshchem, don't cut the hair of your head in a circle. That's all he mentions about that pasuk. And if you didn't know any better, you would think, well, that's maybe what he's saying is he takes haircuts in a non-halachic manner. The way to disprove that is to look at the cover of the book, which has a picture of Shaddai. All the pictures of Shaddai that are available, and there aren't that many, all of them show he has hair where he needs to have hair. He has sideburns. He doesn't take away the halachic parts of the beard that need to be left there. So what is he talking about? Maybe he's talking about the end of that pasuk where it talks about do not destroy the corners of your beard. So then I get into a discussion about, well, does that mean he shaved with a razor? Not necessarily. Many Italian Jews were beardless at that time. Many of those Italian Jews used other means to remove their beards, like depilatories, creams, whatever. Mostly people thought that was okay. Some authorities did not think it was okay. And possibly, if you want to give Shaddai a kafsuchus, possibly what he meant to say was, yes, I remove my beard by this way, this means that some people say is okay and some people say is not okay, but you know what? It's not for mourning, so really, what does it matter? It may be a slightly untraditional kind of thing to say, but it's a way of reading into what he was saying to Rapoport in a way that doesn't violate halacha. I put a feeler out on the internet some months ago about, you know, expressing this way of possibly reading what Shaddai said. I had a very challenging answer from somebody anonymous online saying, this is so far-fetched, it's ridiculous. Obviously what he meant was he was shaving with a razor. And my response was, first of all, it's not obvious. Second of all, okay, it's a little far-fetched to say that he wasn't violating halacha, but it's even more of a problem to say that he was. Because in the rest of his life, as far as we know, he was very machpid about following halacha. He said so in his writings. There was never any indication that this was ever a controversial issue during his lifetime. I mean, he had enemies. They could have said, well, what do you know? You shave with a razor. You never see that. So this is something that's a little difficult to deal with, and I have dealt with it, at least to my satisfaction. The readers will have to decide whether it's to their satisfaction as well. That's what I deal with in Introduction to Vayikra.
Fascinating. So obviously very interesting. And you said he is clean shaven, but the Rabbanim in Italy for many centuries did shave. That was how Italy was. The other thing was, you said he was against reform. Obviously, he was against Geiger, I believe, right? He was anti-reform, and that running very long, and it's not for here. But Italian, like you said, you mentioned this earlier. They were not reformed. They just maybe weren't observant in some ways. That maybe has to do with Italian Jewry over the centuries, how they were different from other Jews in Germany or other parts of Europe. But that's not for here.
Just want to jump in about Geiger. Geiger is one of the scholars who he cooperated with in terms of finding manuscripts and exchanging viewpoints. But he was very much against Geiger's religious philosophy. He drew a line there. He was able to relate to people on the one hand in a scholarly kind of way, but differ with them sharply in terms of hashgacha.
I know you meant hashgacha. Yeah, so that's something. So that's what I meant, that he was against him. So first of all, Bamidbar and Devarim are also in the plans as well?
Yes, they are. What I can't wait to get to in Bamidbar is he has a very interesting take on the whole story of Bilam. He departs from his usual format, and he has a series of numbered questions, kind of like what you see in a Bravano. He said, was Bilam a real Navi or not? What was he trying to do? It's a very fascinating thing, and that's the next thing I'm really looking forward to doing. It may take a while, hopefully not more than a few years, but that's next on deck.
Right. I think the final question, I know we've run long, but hopefully this was useful to people. The final question I would ask you is, you know, what can be gained from learning Shadal today? And why should somebody use his peers, whether it's in Hebrew or in the English? Why?
Okay. That's a very fair question, because there have been those who have said that even though Shadal was very important in his day, as what he called the midwife of Jewish scholarship, because he brought so much old material to life, some will say, well, yes, he had his day, but what he said is obsolete, because we know so much more about the Hebrew language, the development of the Hebrew language. A lot of what he says is just obsolete. First of all, I think that's false, because in my translating work, I've had to be very careful about looking up, if he says something from this Shoresh, I will look it up in a modern Hebrew dictionary and find, yes, it is from that Shoresh. He's surprisingly up to date in what he says, even though he wasn't able to use this very modern branch of scholarship, you know, the more unknown Semitic languages that weren't known in his time. It holds up surprisingly well. The other thing is that even if you don't agree with every perush of his, even if you think that on occasion he's been rendered a little bit obsolete, the process that he went through, I think, is fascinating. He was modern in a way, he was traditional in a way. He was able to marry the two approaches. I think anybody who was able to take that approach and write so beautifully and write so thoroughly in his time is still worthy of attention, because he really is, what he's doing is he's setting an example for people to take up where he left off. There has been scholarship that has taken off where he's left off. The traditional minded people who have taken modern modes of scholarship and applied them to Tanakh. And I think he's the one who sets the path for that approach. And I think reading his Perush even now will, like I said, set an example. And there is a lot, I should point out, that does hold up and does sound surprisingly modern for its time, even though he was writing 150 years ago. And I think there is value in that.
And I would mention also that it I don't mean exact similarities, but it, just somebody just opening them in similar styles. So W.C. Hoffman, like you mentioned, has similar type of thing. He does quote other sources as well. And in a much more traditional way, in a more from way to some many people, like Xav HaKabbalah does as well. A lot of similar kind of, obviously it's different. I'm not comparing the two, but you know, similar kind of things. The other thing I do want to just mention is first of all, the Basi edition. There's a 5-volume edition in Hebrew that came out without the Italian translation. So that's only in yours. But it does have, you know, he did use many manuscripts, and it is some sort of critical edition, so to speak. And he actually just also put out 5 volumes on Nach, a Navi, as well. I don't know how many manuscripts he used there. He says he used some. I don't know how different it is in the old editions, but there's that. So people can get that in the other forum we mentioned as well. I think now alatorah.org also includes Shadal now. I think you can find it there, right?
Yeah, these are both wonderful resources. What Basi has done is a very valuable thing. He's brought back not only the full Perush that was expurgated in the 1960s edition, but he's brought back manuscripts that were not public knowledge before, and you can see the development of Shadal's thought. It's a very important contribution, I think. Alatorah.org, who I've had dealings with, is a wonderful resource online. It has an expanded online Mikra Skadolos, including Shadal and other perushim that don't appear in the usual printed Mikra Skadolos. He has also drawn upon manuscripts, some of which Basi did not see, and has done a wonderful job making Shadal available to the public. One thing I do want to point out, the value of having this all in English. Shadal himself, I think, would have been disappointed that people need to see this in English, because he very much believed in the value of the Hebrew language. He wanted Hebrew to be a living language of the Jewish people. To read his parish in Hebrew is a delight, because it's written so beautifully. But certainly in the non-Jewish world, they need to see this in English. Even in the Jewish world, let's say, unfortunately, it makes it much easier for most people to read all of this in English. Certainly the Italian part is not accessible to most people. I mean, I just happened to be very lucky that I stumbled upon Italian in my own life and was in this unique position to present it to the general public. But having this all in English, I think, adds to Shadal's reputation, reinforces the importance that he has in history, and makes it more accessible to people, even if they should be reading more Hebrew than they are.
And then, and just to promote your work as well, is that also that yours has an index, which the others don't, even Basi's, I don't believe, does. And also yours has footnotes, explanatory footnotes as well. And Basi's edition does not have that. So I don't know about the Alatorah one. So as nice as it is, and Amat, again, it doesn't. And you also have the Italian translation. And something else also in the Hebrew one, he does quote sources that in other languages. So sometimes it's not Hebrew. It's in, I don't know.
Yeah, on occasion he does Latin quotes, and Latin is not a language I've ever actually studied, but now certainly most of what he quotes is online. It's available. I didn't have to bust my chops trying to translate it myself. There's some things I did have to do. There is Latin, there is some German, there is a little bit of French. He does spend a lot of time quoting or referring to Mendelssohn and Mendelssohn's Mefarshim that he brought in. It helps know a little bit of German to understand what he was trying to say, or trying to either agree with him or disagree with him. So that was another little fun part of my work. May I put in a little bit of a plug here? Is that too crass, or is that something I can do? My publisher would like people to know that the Bereishis and Shemos volumes, of course, have been available for some time. The Vayikra volume is available for pre-order. And if you order now, if you go to the kodeshpress.com website, you can get 10% off if you buy one of the books, and 20% off if you order all 3 existing volumes. The Vayikra isn't quite out yet. It's available for pre-order. I have one of the very few copies in my possession, because I was given a copy to help in the proofreading process. But yeah, it's coming out. It's exciting, and I'm moving on. And I'm oddly enough, I have now, I may not look it, but I have lived longer than Chadal ever lived. He unfortunately died at the age of 65. What he accomplished in those 65 years, most people will never accomplish in a much longer life. And if I lived literally to be 100, I will have what to translate in Chadal. I will have a retirement hobby for the rest of my life. And I love it. I want to keep doing it. My goal after finishing the Midbar Nevarim is to get into Yeshaya, because again, that's considered perhaps his masterpiece. His Yeshaya volume is probably is just about the same length as his entire treatment of the Chumash. I may never get to the end, but I would like to try, at least to start. Another thing I want to mention is my daughter. I have three daughters. They're all very smart, also a smart son. One of my daughters is so interested in this Chadal project that she offered to help do some of the translating from Hebrew. I'm a little reluctant to release that to somebody else. But on the other hand, I'm thrilled that somebody else in the younger generation is interested. And so I think I will let her help out and have last editorial word, but it's may become a family project in the future.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And I was going to give you the plug as well, but I was going to say that. So yeah, you were absolutely welcome to say that. I'll include in the show's description the links to Kodesh Press. And as you said, I believe one is 10%. And I think it was two or all three, like you said, you have to get the 20%. So I'll include that information with their promotion code. Anyone that would like to order it, they can. So
eventually on Amazon as well.
Yeah, but just right. You can get an Amazon. You just won't get that extra saving. So I know we run a bit long. I just wanted to, it's a complicated subject. It's a lot to talk about, and it's very interesting. So with that, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. Cut out.